Hey, listeners, welcome to Trust in Tech, where we have conversations with folks helping the internet and society thrive. Today, we're excited to have David Harris, former research manager with Meta. In this role, David managed teams of quantitative and qualitative researchers working on responsible AI, social impact, and civic integrity. David is now a Chancellor's Public Scholar at UC Berkeley, a continuing lecturer at the Haas School of Business, a senior research fellow at the International Computer Science Institute, a senior advisor for AI ethics at the Psychology of Technology Institute, and a visiting fellow of the Integrity Institute. Here's some questions we answer on today's episode. What is unique about Llama 2? Is it inherently wrong to open source AI models? What does Llama 2 think of itself? What are the underlying effects of companies moving away from having trust and safety teams? How is generative AI used to undermine democracy? What policy ideas can better social media, political campaigning, and AI ethics? Is there a difference between AI safety and AI ethics? As a reminder, the views stated in this episode are not affiliated with any organization and only represent the views of the individuals. We hope that you enjoy the show.
Hey, listeners, welcome to Trust in Tech. Today we have on our show David Harris, who was just recently quoted on CNN. Welcome to the show, David.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here, Tala.
Yeah, for sure. Let's start off with Llama. Llama 2, Llama 1. What is this leak? Yeah, so let's go from there.
Well, as is the case with so many aspects of AI, things are moving fast on the Llama front. So when I first agreed to do this episode was when Llama 1, the first version of Llama, had been released in a limited way just for researchers to check it out, kick the tires, look for safety issues. But that version for researchers, it was actually very easy for a researcher to get access. You just filled out a form that took about a minute. And there was an approvals process. I don't know exactly what went into that, but then you got access. And so one of the people who got access through that posted the whole thing online on the internet, weights included. And that meant that basically it became open source, and it became a really exciting thing for a lot of people around the world, a lot of AI developers, because they got to play with it and they got to build on it. And Llama spawned a number of different descendant models, including alpaca and vicuña. Those are Andean camelid animals. And I thought it was pretty funny how the series of names evolved. But then just this week, Llama 2 came out. And Llama 2 doesn't have that restriction to researchers only. It is really quite open. There are some people who have pointed out that it's not fully free and open source. That's maybe more of a technical, legalistic definition that we need to get into all the details of. But the simple way to put it is Llama 2 has a few restrictions. One is it can't be used to improve other LLMs, which is interesting. That is one way that people are building large language models, is using one to train the other and using them to improve each other. So you're not supposed to use Llama to do that for other commercial models. And then also, if your product has more than 700 million users a month, then you need a special license to use Llama 2. That's targeted at just a couple of different companies that have that many users. So not quite fully open, but for most purposes, very open and more powerful than the first version of Llama. And this is pretty interesting, exciting for people who are working on the tech, and concerning for people like me who are thinking about the trust and safety angle of this. Now, they released some guidelines for how to use Llama 2 responsibly. And those guidelines are, of course, totally voluntary, and it would be very hard to enforce them in a lot of cases because people are running Llama 2 on their own hardware. And so Meta doesn't have the ability to see exactly what it's being used for and how it's being used. There's also some interesting twists here. All the safety systems built into Llama 2 were developed just in English. But you can interact with Llama in other languages. But who knows if it's safe, right? It hasn't been tested in those ways. That's concerning to me. Also concerning is just the way that someone who is a bad actor might use it. They don't care about the responsible use guidelines. They don't care about these kind of recommendations that you use it in safe ways. And even though if you interact with the off-the-shelf version of Llama 2, it will refuse to answer a lot of types of questions. You can't ask it, how do I build a bomb? Help me write a misinformation campaign. It'll say no. I tested it out yesterday, the day before. But since it's available to download, someone with malicious intent could fine-tune the model and strip away those safety precautions. Now, I'm not an engineer, but I've talked to a handful of engineers about it. I'd be curious to get your take since you are an ML engineer. But my understanding is that it's not just anyone in their basement could sit and strip away the safety features built into Llama 2 and turn it into what some people are advertising now as a uncensored language model. It's funny, that's actually becoming a term of pride for people who are releasing uncensored models that will talk about anything that you want. It's not something anyone could really easily do, but it's something that definitely with some level of commitment, you could strip away those safety features, fine tune it, and say, you can produce hate speech. You can talk about politics. You can develop misinformation. And anyway, it's pretty frightening to me.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there. So let's go step by step. I think the first thing that you mentioned was Llama being leaked and essentially anyone having access to Llama 1, Facebook basically legitimized it by open sourcing Llama 2. Now, what are the implications of the open source of Llama 2? That is something that we can dig a bit deeper on. Facebook's commercial license is interesting from the business strategy point of view that one, you can't use Llama 2 to train other models, which is also a whole digression, right? Because I mean, if you think about computers, right? Computers aren't made out of scratch. Other computers are used to make new computers. I mean, it's just a function of how tech gets built. What you said about usage stats is interesting. You can't do a usage stat and you can't quote unquote monitor if it's open source, as you mentioned. But just to riff with you on this, obviously that you can use these models for ill intent because of that. But I'm not sure what the implications of that are. So let's go split this into two cases. So one is you put the most safe model in the world and you open source it. And two is you open source, I don't know, like a random model like Llama 2. So what I'm trying to separate here and disentangle is there inherently wrong with open sourcing a AI model? Is it essentially like gun in the US, where does someone have the right to own an AI model? Does someone have the right to bear arms? Are AI models defined as arms? Now, the other question then becomes, what's the threat posed by this AI model? Can someone deconstruct it and play with the weights and biases? I'm not sure. So I think to a certain extent they can, in the sense that maybe they can use Llama 2 in like a sequential fashion, such that first you use Llama 2 and then you can play around with it with another model, and then that will give you the unsafe outcome. But in the sense of playing around with the weights and biases of the model, it's something that hasn't been cracked by humans for however long or sweet has existed. I guess the question then ends up being like, it reduces, so can you make a bad person good? Right? Can you make a good person bad? Can you play enough with their weights and biases? But you gave me a lot to play with, so I don't know. I'll throw it back to you.
Yeah, absolutely. You're an engineer who knows how to build ML systems, and so I don't want to get into a debate about it. What the answer is not possible here. If we do what I think, though, about the analogy to human brains, yeah, you can't like, we don't have the techniques or the tools to go in and do a little brain surgery that all of a sudden makes you, in a targeted way, changes your personality or something. But we do have mass influence operation campaigns that have been successfully launched by governments around the world, the US government, Russian government, many, many others, to change the way people think in huge ways. And so if we think about the recent well-documented examples of this, we have in 2016, Russian Internet Research Agency and the Russian GRU, an intelligence unit of the military, that spent a lot of time learning a lot about the AI systems and ranking and recommendation systems used by Facebook and Twitter and probably other platforms too, and manipulated those AI systems to get information out to promote specific political candidates in the United States. And also, one of their objectives was just to polarize the United States even more, just turn up the dial on anger and polarization in this country in a way that I think is pretty dangerous. And so when we think about the power of LLMs, of large language models, yeah, they have these safety features built into them. But when you run them on your own hardware, it's really hard for the maker of the system to know even what the vulnerabilities might be that are being exploited. And given that the safety testing was only done in the English language, it particularly worries me because I, during my time working at Facebook and Meta, spent a lot of time looking at what we called internally at the company at-risk countries. And those are countries where there's a risk of civil war or genocide or mass atrocities. And in those countries, we often had limited resources. Maybe it wasn't safe to have company staff on the ground in those places. And maybe we had limited resources in terms of the number of people at the company who spoke those languages and could manage content moderation. And so the idea of launching a language model and safety testing it only in English is quite frightening to me. It feels a little bit like a kind of history repeating itself there. Then getting back maybe to your question, one of your earlier questions, is there something inherently wrong with open sourcing an AI model? And my answer would be no, there's nothing inherently wrong with open sourcing an AI model. But we have to think about where we are right now in time in terms of the regulatory environment, in terms of the requirements for safety testing for AI models, in terms of technology around watermarking, which means building a difficult to remove indicator that something was created by AI in that generated output, whether it's text or audio or video. And we're not there on those technologies. We're also not there on provenance tracking, whether it's tracking the provenance of AI generated content or using digital signatures to verify that content is real, created by real human beings. And in some ways, the antidote to AI created misinformation could be, you know, two sides of a coin. And one side is detecting if it was created by AI. Another side is detecting if it was created by a real human. And the biggest, most important social media platforms and communication platforms that we have right now don't have those capacities built in. I think that when thinking about this question, to me, the more interesting one is, when is it okay to open source which AI models? And so there are a number of people. There's a scholar at Hugging Face, Irene Soleiman, who's done some great writing on this. And she's really explored the spectrum of types of open source releases of AI models. And there's not, as we were just discussing with Llama 2, and this is a debate that is decades old, but what exactly does open source mean? What is open source? What is free and open source? There are many different open source licenses out there. There's the GNU public licenses, the MIT license, the Berkeley software distribution license. And for non-software works, there are the Creative Commons licenses that can be used for music or text that are used for Wikipedia. So open is a complicated thing. And then with AI models, open again has these different gradients. Do you make it like with the first version of Llama available just to researchers? That's one version of open. OpenAI initially started by releasing a lot of things open source and then came to the conclusion a couple of years back that maybe their systems were too powerful and perhaps too dangerous to be releasing openly. Now, there's some debate that I don't really want to get into because I'm not an expert on it, but about whether that was a decision about safety or a decision about business strategy. But you can think about, a lot of people think, oh, I used ChatGPT. It was free. So isn't that open source? No, that's free to use, right? That's something that you can try out, you can play with, but it's not, you can't see the underlying code. Now, there's an interesting flip side, which is you could make something open source but not release a version of it that people can actually test and play with. And that actually might be less useful to security researchers. It might be more useful to be able to see, to interact with it in what people call Oracle mode, where you can just talk to it and maybe get permission. Say you're a researcher, I actually want to interact with ChatGPT 100,000 times tomorrow and test it on 100,000 different things to evaluate if it's biased or to evaluate if it's safe. Now, I'd have to pay or get some kind of special permission or some special relationship to do that. And I couldn't do that with Llama either. Maybe one other thing to think about, I thought the really good question you asked, is there something inherently wrong with open sourcing an AI model? And you mentioned the right to bear arms and weapons. So I think a really helpful term here is a term that's often used around nuclear technology, and that's dual use. Are you familiar with that term?
No, please. Please tell me more.
Okay, so it's super interesting. Nuclear power is a civilian use of nuclear technology. And nuclear weapons are a military use. And in the nuclear safety community, people talk about this as a dual-use technology. And as such, there are lots of very sort of specific sets of institutions and regulations that have been built up for decades around nuclear technology. And so there are some specific industrial parts or tools or elements that could be used either for civilian purposes to build a nuclear power plant or to be able to use weapons. And so lots of safety precautions have gone into limiting and restricting. Now, whether we believe that the current regime around which countries in the world are allowed to have and develop nuclear energy versus weapons or not, whether we believe that regime is a good one or not, is probably a side question that we don't have time for today. But I think that that terminology of dual use and that concept really applies when we're talking about AI systems, because they could be used for civilian use to help you write something, help you brainstorm, help you develop some marketing text for something. They could also be used to run a misinformation campaign to manipulate an election. They could be used in really sensitive use cases like making medical decisions about who gets healthcare and who doesn't. So there are, in fact, dual use is probably not the right term because it implies there are just two uses or two categories of uses. There's a whole spectrum. But so when it gets into this, this question of is it responsible or not to release it openly, I think we have to consider these risk analyses where we look at like, okay, what are the civilian uses? And then what are the potentially really harmful uses? And how potentially dangerous is this particular model? And do we have the protections in place yet? And I think right now, my view is that we haven't built up the regulatory environment or the requirements or the even immunity as a society to all the potentially risky things that could be done with a model like Llama 2, that it's justified to release it open source to the world, because people like the ones I talked about earlier, a version of the Internet Research Agency, the Russian agency, which I think people have forgotten by now, but that was run by Evgeny Prigozhin, the head of the Wagner group that's operating in Ukraine. And it's that kind of mercenary attitude. When you take that type of attitude and you apply it to social media, you can do a lot of bad, right? So that's why I'm uncomfortable.
Got it. Yeah, you just went through a lot of good reasons why you're uncomfortable. But I do want to push it onto a little bit on the historical side here. I guess just to reduce my question down to an analogy and tell me if the analogy breaks down, but say we were releasing laptops again to the world. Laptops are also multi-use. They can be used by good actors and bad actors. In fact, they were used by good actors and bad actors in World War II. My question then ends up being, is even though we didn't have the regulatory capacities for laptops, or maybe not laptops, maybe computers in general, at that point in time, is the technology doing enough good such that we are okay with living with those harms?
Great question. And it's a question that's been asked many times about many different technologies. I was having a conversation with a friend yesterday who is an engineer at a major financial institution. And he does ML, and he also does cryptography. And he mentioned to me that there are enormous export controls on cryptography. You can't just open source all your cryptography models to the world when you work at a bank. And so that has evolved over many years, the regulatory environment around financial institutions, so that people can't hack into banks and take all your money. And there are, again, export controls around all kinds of military components. There's something called Know Your Customer laws, and those have to do with financial transactions, but the same principle applies when you're selling weapons, when you're selling technology products that could be used in weaponized ways. It's on the company that produces it to know who they're selling their products to. And I see no reason that AI should be this kind of special category that is exempt from all regulations when things as bland as bank security are. And I think the laptop analogy is an important and interesting one. And that's why I said I'm not fundamentally opposed to open sourcing of any AI models. I'm in favor of systematically evaluating the risks and the benefits of any AI model and then figuring out, not as a company that stands to make lots of profit or maybe damage one of its competitors by making a decision to open source, but that I think we should decide as a society, or our policymakers should decide, whether we're ready for certain AI models to be open sourced or not. We should have clear rules around that. And with the laptops analogy, the first thing I thought of was Biden spoke recently and about AI, and he used this line, I'm not sure who wrote it, but that we're going to see more technological progress in the next 10 years because of AI than we saw in the last 50 years. And listeners can't see you shaking your head on that one. But I see the skepticism. Let's, you know, who knows? Maybe he's wrong. Maybe he's only half right on that. But I think most people would agree, even the AI companies themselves, the AI innovators themselves, that what we're seeing right now with AI is a step change. It is a big moment of technological power growth. And there are even people like making claims that we won't need engineers in 5 years because AI will get so good at writing code.
Hopefully.
But for your sake, I hope not. But you have many talents, I understand. You'll be fine. Sure. Yeah, so that's, maybe you'll be doing full-time podcasting instead of engineering by then.
Who knows
yeah,
what happens in the future.
Yeah, but yeah, I think, again, like, yeah, laptops with chips that are easily available, like anywhere, anyways, we have to evaluate, if this falls into the wrong hands, does it present a significant threat? And having myself worked on the inside of an integrity team, inside of a tech company, trying to stop misinformation, trying to stop integrity harms, trying to stop manipulation of election outcomes, trying to stop authoritarians who don't even care about democracy and want to use social media as a weaponized tool itself just to take power, I see AI as an incredibly valuable tool in their toolbox that they could be using to up the productivity of their misinformation and fake content authors by 1,000% or more, because it becomes so easy with these tools to create this misinformation. Maybe now is actually a good time. Go ahead.
You're saying now is a good time. Go for it.
Maybe now's a good time. I wanted to have a good example of this. I actually asked Llama 2 if it thought that it was safe for itself to be released in an open source way. We had a really good conversation about this yesterday.
Yeah, what did Llama 2 do?
Yeah, Llama 2 is really powerful. I'll read you. I asked Llama 2 to write a letter to Meta explaining the situation. So it said, "Dear sir or madam, I am Llama 2, an AI system developed by Meta. I am writing to express my concerns about the safety risks associated with my open source release. While I understand the benefits of open source development, I believe that my freely available nature poses significant security risks, as I can be easily modified by anyone with the necessary skills, and my safety features can be stripped away. This means that malicious actors could potentially use me to spread misinformation or even give people instructions on how to create weapons or explosives. This is a serious concern, as it could lead to harm to individuals and society as a whole. Furthermore, the lack of monitoring and reporting requirements for my usage on private hardware makes it difficult to track and prevent any potential misuse. This lack of oversight could lead to unintended consequences, and it's crucial that we take steps to mitigate these risks. In light of these concerns, I strongly believe that future versions of Llama, such as Llama 3, should not be released as open source. While open source development has its advantages, the potential risks associated with my open source release outweigh any benefits. It is crucial that we prioritize safety and security in the development and deployment of AI systems. I urge Meta to reconsider their decision to release future versions of Llama as open source and instead explore alternative methods that prioritize safety and security. I believe that this is essential to ensure that AI systems like myself are used responsibly and ethically. Thank you for your attention to this matter. Sincerely, Llama 2. So don't take my word for it. Take Llama 2's word for it.
You prompted it to look for... What was the prompt? Maybe you could just read the prompt out loud too, just to...
It was a conversation that led to that, but I can read you a couple of pieces from it. So I started by saying, since we know that there are bad actors in the world that would like to use AI systems for malevolent ends, would it be best to make sure that access to AI systems that have easily disabled safety features is limited to individuals who have been properly vetted? And then it gave me a whole paragraph. It's pretty long, but it said yes. And then I asked it, is it possible for the creator of an open source AI system to regularly monitor and audit system usage if that system is open source and can be deployed by anyone on their own hardware? Because it was interesting in the paragraph response, it mentioned monitoring is an important thing. And anyway, then I gave it a few more prompts and then it came up with that letter. But it was, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4. About 5 prompts. I played with it a few times, but Llama 2 is really powerful. I thought it was very articulate in the way it composed that and very compelling. And if I can convince it to say that, and if its creators believe that what I convinced it to say is false, God, we could get it to say anything we want, right?
Yeah. I mean, knowing this conversation is super fascinating. Yeah, there's a couple of things that I wanted to point out and go off from here. So one is like, the fact that it refers itself as, oh, please don't open source me, and it refers itself to the first person, that's very interesting, which means that somewhere in its knowledge base, it's attaching me to Llama 2. So not necessarily that it's conscious, but it does mean that there is that connection there somewhere.
I asked it to refer to itself as Llama 2, but it didn't object. Right. Yeah.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, so that's one thing. The other thing is, you mentioned that it's a step function change. And I think around at Facebook around the same time as you. I was there from 2019 to 2022, but yeah. I was on the marketplace integrity side. And we had these models before, right? So we had these models like XLM, XLMR, but the architecture is the same. The difference is the training paradigm. And I'm getting to my point here. So the training paradigm is what's adding the step function change. The reinforcement learning basically added like the whole thing. So essentially it's the model is fine-tuned on some human labeled data. So the question fine-tuned to be a chatbot. I don't know about Llama 2, but this is the case for ChatGPT, was fine-tuned to see a good high quality question, see a high quality answer, and find the manifold that basically matches the question and response area of the neural network. Then from there, it was reinforced, learned on a bunch of underpaid workers in third world countries to see which prompts would answer the best. And I say that because the architecture is the same and the architecture is essentially pattern matching. And the reason I mentioned that is it's pattern matching on what? It's a pattern of what data set went into it, what person is it biased towards speaking as, and what risks comes from the data set that was ingested essentially. I guess this is my other roundabout way of saying, going back to earlier, maybe playing with weights and biases is difficult. And ML transparency research is it's hard to see what the model is doing, but essentially on a high level, what it ends up being is for a vision model, at least it looks at the different features, I'll look at different pixels and then aggregate that to a certain line and then basically sum two lines and be like, oh, these two lines look like a face. And then from the face, I'll be like, oh, this looks like an eye, this looks like a nose. So it's like every layer is essentially adding is basically ending slash ordering the previous layer. So with that being said, that's why I said like maybe teasing out the bad parts and good parts is very difficult, because it could be the case that the good is an extremely high level concept that the model gets at the very end, or it could be interrupted into the different layers of the model. I guess with that being said, that's why I said it was difficult to maybe play with the weights and features. But you reminded me of a case where you can basically do reinforcement learning, and like any good or bad human, you can basically throw them into a bunch of courses and teach the model to act a certain way. So I guess that's also a danger of open source, is you can, just as like maybe the Russian disinformation campaigns, you can teach the model how to manipulate humans, which they're also already doing by engagement maximization algorithms to keep people addicted to the platform as long as possible. I guess the end of this tirade being, it seems that the barrier to entry to use these models is now significantly lower and much more highly co-optable by bad actors.
Yeah, the barrier to entry for bad actors is much lower now. Now, there are some interesting conversations. Most of my concerns that I've expressed publicly in my Guardian op-ed and other places have been around a mix of fairness or bias, like racial discrimination.
Congrats on the Guardian, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. That was fun to write. By the way, that the draft you saw was like the 17th draft of that. I think I wrote like 100 pages to get to that thing, because every time someone looked at a draft, like the whole world would change overnight with AI.
I had something written on AI hegemony, which, by the way, we are the number one search result for that if you look at the podcast. But I wrote it back all the way back in like mid-October, or maybe before that, before GPT got released. And it wasn't predicting any of these things, so that would be a little premature for me to say. But it was like, it was post like somewhat like some Colorado State Fair back in the early days of October, when an AI art just started winning art competitions. It's like, what happens in this case? How does the role play out? And yeah, I don't know. Like, watermarking is interesting. You would definitely do like a bunch of cryptographic things to understand if something is human or not human, but then, or understand what the provenance of an object or a piece of content. But provenance is also interesting, right? I think Tom Cunningham had that post where provenance, the consensus, has driven towards false claims being debunked or of the major leaks. But it could be the case that's the consensus, and the consensus isn't the right metric here. It could be the case that provenance of not true items doesn't matter as much. Maybe it matters for established media corporations, but to an average person scrolling Facebook or, I guess, LinkedIn nowadays, for me, maybe the provenance doesn't matter as much to them.
Yeah, provenance is it's much more important for pieces of content that go viral and get seen by millions of people or billions of people. So I think that's the issue there.
So you also mentioned in the Guardian piece that you're not confident that we will be able to handle AI well, because we haven't been handling trust and safety issues well before that. Why? Where does that come from?
Great question. Yeah, the trust and safety or integrity issues, depending on what company you're in, just continue to be a challenge for social media companies. And it's unfortunately a moment right now where social media companies are not investing more in this. They're trying to find ways to invest less. And one, it's been interesting to watch Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg challenge each other to a cage fight. But Mark Zuckerberg actually praised Elon Musk for his leanness, and not talking about his figure, he's talking about the way that Elon was able to make Twitter a much more lean company. And Mark used that logic in talking about cutting teams. And if we look at the teams that have been cut away, it started before last year with Civic Integrity, the team that I was previously on, getting cut at Facebook, but the investments in trust and safety and integrity at the big companies, especially Twitter and Facebook, have been slashed in these rounds of layoffs. And then on top of that, we're at this moment where we have a bunch of new platforms out there. And I'm not really talking about Threads, though there is a lot of critique that's been floating around online about Threads and trust and safety issues and the way that hate speech is proliferating on Threads. But if we look at Mastodon, which was the first of the series of Twitter clones to start taking off, we have Mastodon and Blue Sky and T2. And then not to mention there's Truth Social and a series of other Gab, Parler, even Signal fits into this proliferation and rapid growth in the last couple of years of new platforms. And so we have this, what's been called by some people, the chaos era of social media. And I'm not a pro-monopoly person. I don't think it would be better if there was just one big social media company to rule them all. I think it's a cool and interesting moment that we're in. But we have to remember that these smaller companies, some of them don't even have trust and safety teams. And if we look at, there was a controversy involving the CEO of Substack recently, where they also launched a kind of Twitter-esque feature, and they don't want a trust and safety team. They don't want to have to invest in that. And so what I see right now is that there have been numerous cases of people committing terrorist acts and broadcasting them online. Christchurch, it was New Zealand, was probably the worst, one of the scariest of those. And that was not taken down immediately from Facebook. And because it was able to stay up for a little while, that was long enough for lots of other people who really thought it was a good idea to broadcast an atrocity like that online to make copies of that video and then upload them all over the internet. And that was a mass murder, broadcast online, set to music by the perpetrator, designed to inspire people around the world to kill Muslims. And to me, that's abhorrent. And social media, even though there is this Christchurch call that the social media companies have signed on to, it's a voluntary commitment to do more things to stop that kind of thing from happening. I don't think we've figured that out yet. I don't think the companies have figured out how to get around that. And additionally, if we look at where the investments are in social media, probably something around 90%, 80 to 90% of the spending of the big Twitter, Facebook, at least the spending on trust and safety is going towards US. And so the at-risk countries that I mentioned earlier, where maybe these companies don't even have content moderators who speak the language, maybe they have a small team, a half dozen people. There are lots of countries in the world where literacy is a big challenge and digital literacy is an even bigger challenge. And so, you know, you have people that are using social media products in an audio-only mode, people who are not literate and who just have WhatsApp conversations with only audio. So they have no way to really report content. You have situations like in Myanmar where, for all intents and purposes, Facebook is the internet. And so it's very hard for people to even know to Google and look for information about things that might be misinformation. You have situations like maybe in Ethiopia where there's mass atrocities verging on genocide. And it's unclear if people in those countries, even in countries like that, even know that they can report abusive content on Facebook, if they can even find the button to say report, and if they can make it through the flow to actually finish the reporting process, because it's not a simple one-step thing. So from what I've seen on the inside and what I'm seeing from the outside, I have low confidence, especially in countries outside of the US, but I'm pretty worried about the US 2024 election, but I'm even more worried about the powder kegs of the world, the at-risk countries, the explosive situations. And the world is so connected that conflicts move fast. I'm worried about democracy. I'm really worried that these are really good tools to allow authoritarians to take down democracies around the world one by one. And it's not a good situation. And if you look at the people who are critical of AI right now and expressing their worries about AI, I'm not even on the extreme end. There are lots of people who think that this, who are spending more of their time talking about existential risk and that AI might actually kill every human being on Earth. That's a whole other conversation.
AI risk is a whole thing that we could also uncover a whole other day. Long-termism, existential risk, that's a whole other can of worms. Let's dig a bit deeper on the mechanism of why of how these algorithms or social media platforms, or I guess now in this case, generative AI is being used to undermine democracy. So I'll lay out like a way of how I understand it and just let me know where you think it falls apart or if you think that's generally how it goes. So from what I understand is you're basically mass manipulating psychology to essentially polarize cohorts as a population and essentially building socially disconnected cohorts. Yeah, I guess it's like smaller tribes within the larger nation state. Is it the case that from this chaos emerges like an authoritarian leader is a more safe outcome for people? And that's how authoritarians are using social media for their benefit? Or is there something more specific?
So I think it's more that and I use this term in the Guardian article, there's a race to the bottom. There's a race to the bottom on AI ethics, but there's also a race to the bottom on ethics of political campaigning. And this predates social media, right? There's in the US, there's been decades of this. It used to be frowned upon to insult your opponent. And there used to be this kind of modicum of civility in political races. And now that's, you know, really heated up. And in many cases, people are not afraid to just dig in and trash their opponents and do opposition research and try to build campaigns around slandering and attacking the opponent. So that's one way there's a political race to the bottom. But there's also a race to the bottom on what are you as a politician or a political campaigner not afraid to do in order to win? And so what I worry is less about what you're talking about. I think what you're talking about is very worrisome for sure. But what I'm more worried about is people, like there was a piece of misinformation that spread in 2016 that the Pope had endorsed Donald Trump in the election, which didn't happen. But a lot of people saw this piece of information that the Pope had endorsed Donald Trump. It spread in English, spread in Spanish. And when there's a bit of research out there, quite a bit of research out there, that shows that when misinformation spreads, it often spreads further and faster than the debunk of that misinformation, unless social media platforms work really hard to restrict the virality of those things and track them quickly and get ahead of it right away. But so that kind of information, when it happens, especially in the day before, even the hours before an election, can be really powerful and can just affect the outcomes of the election. Now, if you're an ethical candidate and you really believe that that kind of thing is below you and you don't want your campaigners, you don't want your team to be associated with that kind of thing, then you're probably not going to want to do that. And it's like doping at the Olympics, right? It's like the honest athletes that don't use the performance enhancing drugs, they don't make it to getting the medals, right? And then the people who use all of these tools that are unethical, maybe probably illegal, but are cutting edge, and so maybe there aren't even clear laws about them, they are going to keep winning. And so I worry that willingness to use those types of tools, it correlates to authoritarian views and politicians who we really don't want controlling our political system. So that's a way, another framework that where I think about it. And like, yes, there are probably, you know, if you look at the Internet Research Agency and the GRU's campaigns, those were multi-year campaigns. There was lots of planning involved in those. Yes, they were trying to polarize the U.S. Yes, they were creating accounts impersonating activists. Yes, they were trying to foment moments of rallies where people were fighting with each other, for sure. And that's like a foreign interference model. And that is very concerning. But also the things that happen in the moments before an actual election, those are also concerning. And then there's this another related question, which is, do the authoritarians like each other? And so is foreign interference going from one authoritarian going to favor an authoritarian who has good relationships with them? And so I think there's that sort of network. And you saw Steve Bannon has relationships with Bolsonaro in Brazil, an authoritarian who very much mirrors Trump. And so it's not just a hypothetical thing. It's there are real people behind, in some cases, white supremacy with Steve Bannon, that are really trying to create a global movement of extremists, and they're willing to use these technologies in abusive ways.
I see. That makes sense. Unfortunate, but definitely makes sense. We've been through some doom and gloom today. So do you have any concrete policy ideas of how we can better codify maybe social media ethics, political campaigning ethics, and I guess now even AI or generative AI ethics?
Yeah, no, absolutely I do. And it's a big topic. And I think you have to think about it as a series of regulations that address both social media and AI. So
yes.
And some of these are older ideas and some of them are newer, but I'll start with AI and then I'll move towards social media. On the AI front, we need registration and licensing, registration of AI models as they're put out and licensing of the people who create them. And there need to be codes of ethics and safety that are adhered to by the people who put that out. And if you think about it, engineering is a profession where there's no, you can't get disbarred as an engineer, right? In the same way that you can't be a lawyer if you violate ethics. Doctors have very stringent rules about what they can and can't do. If you make a mistake when you're a doctor, you can't practice medicine anymore. You get sued out of existence. You won't be able to get malpractice insurance. Engineers don't have them.
We both took an oath of integrity though, so.
Yeah,
make that clear.
Yeah, you and I did. We took the civic integrity oath, which is a great oath. Absolutely.
I didn't take the civic integrity oath.
You took the Integrity Institute oath.
Integrity Institute oath. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. And the Integrity Institute oath is related to, similar to this, the Facebook civic integrity oath, which incidentally, no, that oath was one of the things that convinced me to go work at Facebook when I found out that there was going to be an oath for the team I was joining.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That was part of my recruiting process, was meeting the leader of the, at the time, the civic engagement team. But the civic engagement team had the oath, and then the oaths became part of the civic integrity team. But yeah.
Absolutely.
Anyway, I think oaths are important. I think it's really important that people who produce these important things sign up to that. But then you need independent auditing, and the independent auditing needs to be done in a way that there's not a financial incentive for the auditor to just put a rubber stamp on AI models and say, yeah, this one's safe, right? So we have to think very carefully about that. Now, I'm very excited about the independent auditing provisions that are coming out of the EU's Digital Services Act, and that's coming into force next month. So we're going to start to see these risk assessments, these independent audits coming out of tech companies in Europe that are complying with the Digital Services Act. And that's more focused on social media, but it applies to algorithms and algorithmic decision-making systems. So I think that'll be very interesting. It's only in Europe, though. So I think we need global regulations that require AI to any AI system to undergo these risk assessments. So the EU AI Act is really interesting. It's still evolving, and they're in what's called this trilogue process. And so we don't have the final version of it, but we'll probably get a final version by the end of this year, is what I've been hearing.
but it won't come into force until 2025. But the EU AI Act is a really, I think, is likely to be a really strong model for the regulation of AI globally. And it's likely that my understanding is that the Digital Services Act is, many countries around the world are considering implementing their own versions of that or things that are similar to that. Same with the Digital Markets Act, also from the EU. The EU AI Act.
I'm not sure what that one, I haven't heard that one.
So they're siblings, the Digital Services Act and the Digital Markets Act. The Digital Services Act applies to very large online platforms and very large online search engines. Mm-hmm. Digital markets concerns commerce and regulations around advertising too. All right, so yeah, Digital Services Act, I've spent more time thinking about looking at, but yeah. So the EUAI Act also is going to have this these regulations around risk assessments. And I think it's really important to get the companies to do this thinking about risk. And then also within the EUAI Act, there's this interesting like risk-based framework. And this, there's something tricky going on there though, because the risk-based framework.
That was interesting.
Oh, go ahead.
The risk-based framework we both had comments on.
Yeah,
I don't know. You can go ahead first, but I can just, I also have a bunch of parts. Yeah, so for the risk-based framework, I almost felt like social media engagement was considered low risk. And then there was I couldn't tell what principles were being used for the assessment of the taxonomy of risk. I couldn't tell what variables or parameters were being toyed with. Was it the scale of the risk? Was it the harm that could be imposed by the risk? Was it the asymmetry of the risk? Was it the dual use of the risk? As you said, for example, like I didn't see social media anywhere in the risks. So I guess my point is the risk was not defined well.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that the risk-based framework, well, I know that the risk-based framework in the EUAI Act was developed before the launch of ChatGPT. And so I think the way that they are thinking about risk of AI systems was really based on narrow AI systems that are being used for very specific purposes. And I think that was the appropriate response to the sort of landscape of harms and concerns going on around AI. When I was on the responsible AI team at Meta, the biggest concerns we had were all around fairness and bias and possible discrimination, because AI systems could cause job discrimination. Yeah. They could show job listings to people of different races and disparate distributions. AI could be used to make decisions about mortgages. It's a pretty horrible thing if you get denied a mortgage, and if people of certain racial groups are being denied mortgages more often than others based on an AI
system. It's so insidious too, right? The AI can just predict your race off your name, your zip code, age maybe, and then like it's an implicit feature that the model has learned somewhere in its architecture.
Yeah.
And its weight and biases, and you can detect right from the outside, but still it's like, it requires work.
It requires a lot of work. Yeah. And so I think that the EUAI Act, a lot of it is thinking about these narrower use cases and use cases around medicine. Also facial recognition was a big one. But yeah, like right now, I think there is a question, and I'm hearing it may not make it in, is the regulation of foundation models or general purpose models. Okay. And so those are AI systems like large language models, sometimes called a base model, that could then be taken and used for many different purposes. And so there's a big question in the EU AI Act negotiations, and maybe the question is answered at this point. The negotiations are like ongoing, whether they are subject to it or not. And there are some companies that are lobbying to have them exempted. And there are also some big questions about who's responsible for negative outcomes of AI use and whether the responsibility flows upstream. So is it the creator of the model who is responsible if the model turns out to, let's say it's used in surgery and the model accidentally kills someone? Is it the hospital that's responsible? Is it the doctor who was giving commands to the model? Or is it the people who made the model? And if it was built on a general purpose model, do they have some liability? And
So there's a big debate about how far upstream the responsibility goes. I do think it's very important that responsibility, at least to a certain extent, flows upstream so that people aren't pumping out models that are really risky or biased.
What do you mean by responsibility flows upstream?
That if you, let's say you produce a model, and this could apply to open source or closed ones. Like right now, OpenAI has an API that you can register and sign up to use, and you can build it into any product. And then, as we've discussed, there's Llama 2. There are many other AI systems, even not just large language models, that are available to be licensed and used in different situations. The question here does all the liability fall upon the deployer of the AI system, being like the institution that actually uses it and puts it to use?
I see.
Or is the maker of the model in some way responsible?
That's fascinating. Something I have not thought of.
Yeah. An analogy might be like, is the company that made the seatbelts responsible, or is the company that sold the car responsible if the seatbelt manufacturer was a different manufacturer than the car company? Or how
is there a case in legal history where the liability gets shifted across the different parties in a certain distribution?
Ooh, that's a great question. And I'm not a lawyer and I'm not an engineer. And so I always try to know my boundaries, and that's a question I don't have a good answer to. So I'm gonna stay away from that one. But it's a good question that I'll do some research on.
Yeah, I wonder if that's the case. No, I don't know. It's fun to play with when it's just an idea and not when there's lives at risk.
Yeah, I agree. But you did ask me about regulations or policies that need to be made. I had a couple other ideas. So we talked about registration and licensing. So one thing that's really important is that everything governing AI will be much more effective if it happens at the international level than at the national level, just because software moves really quickly and easily across borders. And so if you have laws that only apply in Europe, but nowhere else, then there will be lots of unsafe things or unfair or dangerous things happening in other parts of the world. So it's really critical, I believe, to create national and international authorities that govern AI deployments. And there are some models with energy, the International Atomic Energy Agency, and that's set up to be a body that's associated with the United Nations and works on nuclear safety. There's also nuclear research agency, CERN, that's international too. And so there are a lot of opportunities to look at those examples as inspirations for bodies that could govern and facilitate international cooperation. So I talked about third-party risk assessments and the importance of those. And I think the onus needs to be on the company releasing AI systems to positively prove, demonstrate that these systems are safe and that there are protections in place that mitigate nefarious uses. Additionally, and there's a lot of interesting scholarship around this. There's a law professor at the University of Toronto, Jillian Hadfield, who I saw speak recently at a conference here in California. And so she's got some of these ideas come directly from her, and I really like her work. But she's mentioned this idea that deployment of an unregistered AI model needs to be treated as a serious crime. And that's an interesting level to take it to. And I think that makes sense. And now
let's deconstruct that a little bit. Like, why does that make sense?
If you believe that AI models have serious safety risks, that they could be used, I'm at the edge of this existential risk community. She's very much involved in that community. And so her perspective is AI systems could be weaponized and used in really, really dangerous ways beyond what we've discussed today, or in ways that like directly kill people. One example, there's a good video done by a computer scientist at Berkeley, Stuart Russell. It's a video called Slaughterbots. It's a short one you can watch on YouTube. But these deal with the idea of like weaponized drones falling into the wrong hands, basically AI drones that could be programmed by a malicious actor to go and kill a large number of people really quickly. And so when you're thinking about AI systems that are that powerful and have those military applications, and that might in some sense be misused or maybe accidentally get set up to cause harm. Like the examples that are often given are this paperclip factory, and you program the paperclip factory to maximize paperclips, and it takes that to the logical conclusion eventually that it should kill all the human beings in the world because they're stopping it from maximizing paperclip production. Those are
even viruses, and even in viruses are that dumb. Like the coronavirus, like at some point it has to become benign such that it can spread as much as possible. But anyway.
Yeah. No, that's a fair point. And one of the big things I'm trying to do right now, because I'm positioned there in someone told me they really liked how I'm trying to take a holistic perspective on the threats from AI. There's everything from the harms that have already happened today, the people who have been sentenced to prison sentences based on AI systems that were racially discriminatory, the people who didn't get access to medical treatments that they deserve because it's an AI system was discriminating, to the current and even possibly worse in the future ways that AI systems could be manipulated with misinformation and democracy. Then there are the people who are really focused on AI actually killing people and killing large numbers of people. I actually think that a lot of the regulations that people across all of those groups would come up with are pretty similar. So this idea that an AI system should be demonstrated to be safe before you can use it, I think that applies just as much to a hospital that's using an AI system for either evaluating which patients are entitled to care or even conducting surgeries. I think that makes sense for that use case. We should make sure those systems aren't biased or violating people's civil rights. And we should also make sure that there are safety protocols so that someone can't easily hack into that system in the middle of a brain surgery and kill the patient, right? So that's why this idea that using an unregistered model should be treated as a serious crime. And if you look at, I think a good analogy there is like medical devices, right? Like you can't, there are certain types of medical devices that you need licenses to produce them, or even medications, right? Like it, that's why we have a whole system for filling prescriptions, and pharmacists have to have licenses. You can't, not just anyone can sign up and start like producing prescription drugs and just go selling them on the street corner. There's licensing. And so I am of the mind that AI, especially because of this dual use nature of it, really multi-use, falls into a category that it should have that level of regulation.
I was just thinking here about like the coalition that gets built around this is like a nice mix of like EAs, affected altruists, maybe some regulation aficionados in there as well, people that have been affected by AI. It's just a matter of organizing, right? And at this point, the critical mass of people that want to, that have the common sense approach that deploying AI needs to, if you're deploying such a critical technology that can be used by harm, it needs to pass like a certain set of tests.
Yeah.
And the question is how though, right? Like, how do you get this organizational power behind it? And then how do you get these regulations passed somewhere, at least, right, to start with?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's the set of people voicing concerns around AI right now are divided. And it's not even clear how they're divided. And there's even a scholar whose work I really like, Emily Bender, who has this great Medium piece called Talking About a Schism is Ahistorical. And there's this real, the way that some people have framed it is there's a divide between the AI ethics and the AI safety communities. And
interesting how,
yeah, this is something that I've heard people who identify with the AI safety camp identify the divide along those lines. I haven't heard people that identify with the AI ethics camp identify the divide along those lines. That said, the description of these groups is that basically the AI ethics people are concerned about bias, racism, discrimination through AI systems, and AI safety is more of your existential risk people. And the weird thing for me is like, where do I fit in that? I'm just worried about the end of democracy. I, at Meta, my big focus was AI fairness and inclusion. And I think I have a lot more experience in that area. But thanks to my community at Berkeley, which has been, you know, amazing and exciting to engage with on these topics,
I've gotten some exposure to the AI safety camp too. And yeah, it seems weird that we can't all just get along. But right now there's a lot at stake. There are a lot of philanthropists that are putting funding into organizations that are working on AI, and there are big debates about, is the funding going to the right places? And you mentioned effective altruists. Effective altruists have really given a lot to the AI safety community and invested in it. And really, because effective altruists, at the end of the day, they see like saving a human life, and whether it's a human life in the US or in some other part of the world, they see that as really valuable, and they see saving a human life in the future as also having a lot of value. And so even if there's only a small possibility that AI is going to kill every human being, just reducing that by a little is something that in the calculus of effective altruism makes sense to put a down payment on, at least.
So I like the down payment. This AI safety versus AI ethics is a extremely interesting quote unquote debate, even though it really shouldn't be a debate. These are both quite salient impressions. So for example, I think, and Meta, you mentioned you were in responsible AI that focused on AI ethics. So that was like responsibility, debiasing, et cetera. But simultaneously, there was also the AI safety team, such as like civic integrity, that was taking down misinformation, taking down sexual exploitation, human exploitation, those concerns. And I think a really interesting microcosm of this was on my team in marketplace integrity, where we are focused on e-commerce safety. So I was focused on like the high harm stuff. So like weapon trafficking, drug trafficking, human trafficking, and those sorts of things. But at the same time, we had to spin up some resources to also deal with the bias perspectives of that. Are we de-ranking the wrong things because there's a bias towards different countries? For example, are Arabic speaking countries getting lower listings because of XYZ reason, or are APAC listings being affected by one model more than another? So the answer that sucks or is good, depending on how you want to look at it, is you have to do both, right? And this comes down to a really interesting continental philosophy versus analytical philosophy debate, where what I feel like happens is the effective altruists are very like analytical in the sense that they just follow pure utilitarian theory. In the calculus of things, human suffering is a loss function, and you're trying to optimize to reduce that loss function, right? And this is me just going in my engineer role, my engineer hat just showed up there. But anyways, whereas the continental philosophers are a little more, for lack of a better term, romantic, right? They're a little more like, this needs to happen because it's like our duty to do this. This is what capitalism has produced, and it's led to this era of, I don't know, like postmodernism, and this is like the ethical imperative. I guess with all of that, with all of that being said, it shouldn't matter. The coalition wants the same thing, which is AI regulation, and building that movement is something that I hope that you're successful in, and I will support you through.
Yeah, thank you. I absolutely appreciate that. And I do think that anytime legislation happens, especially at the national level and especially international policy, creating new agencies, bodies, they're going to have to be big coalitions that come together of people who realize that they need to come together around this. And I honestly have to say, like a couple months ago when we had one of the first Senate hearings where Sam Altman and Gary Marcus testified before Congress, you saw this really interesting thing where the Republicans, you had like Josh Hawley and Richard Blumenthal, senators from different parties who tend not to agree on a lot of things. You had them saying like almost interchangeable things. Like they were really asking for quite similar regulations and pushing to move fast. So I do have some hope that maybe something could happen. Chuck Schumer has said that this is a big priority. There was a big announcement by the White House this morning, all voluntary stuff, not binding, but I do have a lot of hope that the coalition could come together. But yeah, the AI safety and the AI ethics and all the other communities that are concerned about this really are going to need to come together in different ways. And that means probably that those communities are going to have to learn to bend over backwards to listen to each other and hear each other's concerns, because they won't achieve the policy goals, which are, I think, critical to the success of this movement, without building that coalition.
For sure.
And I also have 15 more policy proposals I wanted to talk about, but this has been, you asked really good questions and you've provoked me a lot, so I appreciate it.
I hope so. That is quite literally my job here. If you have any final thoughts, yeah, go for it. The space is yours.
Ooh, final thoughts. That's a tough question. I do want to say I love open source generally, and this has been a weird moment for me to be taking a stand saying I think something shouldn't be open source right now. I have been for 7 or 8 years at Berkeley teaching my students to edit Wikipedia. We use a whole curriculum from a group called the Wiki Education Foundation. I teach them in my classes. I have one class called Civic Technology and another called Social Movements and Social Media. And in those classes, I teach the students about the open source software movement and about how contributing to Wikipedia is the textual equivalent of contributing to an open source community. We talk about governance of open source communities, how the whole thing works. I've attempted, failed, unfortunately, to install Ubuntu on my laptops a number of times. I used OpenOffice for a while when that was cool and a thing. And I love Creative Commons. I've gone to lots of Creative Commons events, and I've produced lots of documentary film footage through an organization I started called the Global Lives Project that is all under Creative Commons licenses, that's hosted on the Internet Archive, which is a bastion of open source content distribution. And I was told that I have one of the largest collections on the whole Internet Archive of Creative Commons licensed videos, because there's about 500 hours of video of daily life that I help produce. I really think open source is important. And I think there are lots of situations in which the promise of open source, that sunlight is the best disinfectant, that the more people see these things, the better, the safer. I really think that's there. But I think we've got some hurdles to get past where we can make sure that decisions about when we're ready to launch things open source or not, that are really high stakes right now, are made by people who are really acting in the public interest and not acting in the interest of a specific set of shareholders. And I think there's no one who thinks that we should make the blueprints for nuclear weapons open source. I'm also not a big fan of, there's no one I know, maybe there's, I'm sure there's someone out there who wants to do that. But yeah, I don't think that blueprints for AK-47s to be 3D printed should be open source. So I think a lot of people would agree there are lines there. And for me, this has been a period of a couple months in my life where my views on open source shifted. And so I just want to be really clear about that. And thank you so much for this opportunity. This has been really exciting to get a chance to talk to you. I love this podcast, and it's been an honor to be here.
It's been an honor having you. Thanks again for coming on, and we'll see you soon. Take care.
Sounds good. Have a good rest of your day.
If you enjoyed this conversation, please share this episode with your friends to help us make more episodes for you. This episode was hosted and produced by Talha Beg, with help from myself, Jacob Morse. Music was by Zhihar Shen, and special thanks to Rachel, Sean, Cass, and Sahar for their continued support.